Book 7. Your Private Shore. Lie still. The jagged, urgent heat, the horn-twisted acts so unconscionable. I have run far from the mob, torn the veil and bled in holes under your very feet. Take my word, not for a day, not a year, not a century. What I will say charges the echo of a thousand years unchained, and all the pillagers of derision, pacing the mouths of caves, march legions of dust, back and forth, like conquerors, and the juddering ways, the skittered agitations, the bridled and the umbraged. My tears appease not your thirst. My blood was never for you. I am running still, alone as I have ever been, and this kissing air on my face, from here to forever, is clean and pure as wonder. Legions of Dust, Atalict. Chapter 21. He was not a modest man. Contemplating suicide, he summoned a dragon. Gothos Folly. Gothos.
Even should you succeed, Cassilian, beyond all expectation, beyond even all desire, they will still speak of your failure.
He stood in the place where the whirl had manifested, a wounding in the fabric of shadow, a place now slowly healing. There was nothing else here, nothing to give evidence to the struggles that had occurred, the blood that had been spilled. Still, chaos felt closer than it ever had, as if moments from erupting once again. The madness of sorcerers, the ambitions of the starved. We're surrounded by fools wanting more than what they have. And alas, it's all too familiar company, and the ugly truth is that we may not be out of place in that crowd. Edgewalker's words haunted him. The breathtaking ambition, the sheer verve of all that they had set in motion. But now we have finally arrived. It's all cut loose, and so much is out of our hands. He saw footprints in the grey dust, reminding him that there were other arenas, distant places where battles raged on. Nothing was simple, and in the spilling of blood, no one could guess the myriad channels it would carve. Shadow Throne, old friend, we have done what we could. But the game is much bigger than we ever imagined. This gamble, gods, this gamble. One hand drifted to one of the knives at his belt, and then he shook himself, straightening. Take a deep breath, lad. Here goes.
What you ask of me, it is too much. Yes, of course, I see the necessity. I may have sickened, even threatened, but magic is not my enemy. It never was. Indeed, I envy its gifts to this world. Upon my own, no matter. Belief can be rotten. All it takes is one betrayal to steal away an entire future. You would not have recognized me in my anger. It shone blinding bright. There remain those among the multitudes I left behind who imagine themselves gods for all their mortal trappings. They would maintain a tyranny such as no true god could ever imagine. They would enslave generation upon generation, all those sharing the same soil, the same water, the same air. They conspire to keep them on their knees, bowed in servitude. And each slave, measuring his or her life, can see, if they dare, only the truth. And so most of my world, most of my children, live a life of despair and suffering and ever-growing rage. Is this all there must be? The tyrants would have it so. I sometimes dream. Yes, I know you have little time. I dream of returning, swords blazing with holy vengeance. I dream, Shadow Throne, of murdering every one of those fuckers. Is this what it means to be a god? To be an implacable weapon of justice? Wouldn't that be nice? I agree. No, I'm not that much of a fool. It will be no different. And should you achieve the impossible with your handful of mortals, should you free me and find the path, the moment I take my first step upon the soil of my home, they will emasculate me, bleed me, gut me, and then stretch my hide overhead. They'll need shade from the torrid heat of all the fires they themselves lit. That is the problem with tyrants. They outlive us all. I will do what you ask. Rather, I shall try. Pieces of me remain missing, and I despair of ever seeing them again. It is my understanding that the one named Skinner, usurper and tyrant king of my House of Chains, has many enemies. He can now count me among them. Do you imagine he loses sleep? No, I don't either. Betrayers never do. Shadow Throne, you will not betray me, will you?
Carsa Orlong, where are all the gods of peace?
He stepped outside, straightening. I know not. Pika turned to face the city. Many troubles there. Perhaps at last they had begun to settle. But all that boiled beneath the surface, well, that never went away.
Do you know how to get there?
He eyed her. I know how to get there. She drew a deep breath. She could hear movement inside the hut behind the giant. Pika lifted her gaze until it locked with the Toblakai's.
I call upon the vow you made long ago, Carsa Orlong of the Teblor. When you walk to where you must go, a crippled priest will find you. In the street, a broken man, a beggar, and he will speak to you, and by his words you shall understand.
I already understand, Malazan.
Carsa,
there are too many gods of war.
And then he took up his sword, and inside the hut a woman began weeping.
And not one of them understands the truth.
Carsa,
his teeth were bared as he said,
when it comes to war, woman, who needs gods?
She watched as he set off, and under her breath she whispered,
Darujistan, I beg you, do not get in this man's way.
Dust roiled over the distant encampment. Squinting, Paran took another bite of the alien fruit his foragers had found and wiped at the juices dribbling down into his beard.
That is not helping, Hyphist.
He glanced over. Ormulogan was scratching desperately on a bleached board with his willow charcoal stick. At his feet squatted a fat toad, watching his efforts with gimlet eyes.
Nothing will help that, the toad sighed.
Posterity, snapped the imperial artist.
Posterity, my ass, Gumble replied. Oh, was that not droll of me? Critics are never appreciated for what they truly are.
What? Leeches sucking on the talents of others, you mean?
It is my objectivity that you so envy, Ormulogan.
And you, the artist muttered, can stick that objectivity up your posterity, toad.
Paran took a last bite of the fruit, examined the furry pit, and then flung it over the wall. He wiped his hands on his thighs and turned.
Fist writhe bude.
The woman was leaning out over a parapet. She straightened.
Sir?
Assemble the companies at their stations. It's time.
Aye, sir.
Lounging nearby, Noto Boyle drew the fish spine from between his front teeth and stepped forward.
Is it truly?
Weapons, said Paran, kept hidden away. But there comes a time, Noto, when they must be unsheathed. A time, in fact, to put proof to the pretensions. He eyed the cutter. The gods have been kicking us around for a long time. When do we say enough?
And in their absence, High Fist, will we manage things any better?
No, Haran said, walking past him. But at least then we won't have the option of blaming someone else. Sister Belai scanned the distant walls, suddenly not a soldier in sight.
They've quit, she said. Now, the question is, do they leave the way they came, or do they march out from the gate, or what's left of it, and try to break the siege?
Standing beside her, Watered Exigent glanced back at the camp.
If the latter, sister, then we are perhaps in trouble.
Sister Belai pretended not to hear him. If his seed of doubt thirsted for water, he would have to find it elsewhere.
Another week, that is all we need. And then Brother Serenity will be here with 5,000 heavily armored foreigners.
The besieging forces were damaged. That last assault had been brutal. She was down to half strength. Her hold on them was fragile, and this was not a familiar feeling.
I see no movement at the gate, Sister Belai.
There was a barrier to dismantle, and that would take time.
But I feel it. They're coming for us. Assemble the companies, Exigent. That gate is the bottleneck. If we can lock them there, we hold them until they're exhausted, too mauled to force the issue.
And if they break us instead?
She turned, studied him.
Do you doubt the power of my will? Do you imagine that this master of the deck can manage anything more than fending me off? I will not yield, Exigent. Understand that. And if it means that every single one of our Shriven and every single one of their watered commanders ends up a corpse on the field, then so be it.
Watered Exigent paled, and then he saluted.
I will inform the commanders that we shall advance.
Have them ready, Exigent. The command to advance shall be mine and mine alone.
Of course, Sister Belai.
After he had left, she returned her attention to the keep. Still no activity at the barricade.
Perhaps my feeling about this is wrong. Perhaps indeed he flees through a warren, and just like that the siege is done. But he will return. Somewhere. This thorn is yet to leave our side, I am certain of it.
Her eyes narrowed, and she blinked rapidly to clear a sudden blurring of her vision. But the problem was not with her eyes. To either side of the barricaded gate, the massive walls had grown strangely smudged all along the breadths, as if stone had become water. And from these places, troops appeared in formation, and then skirmishers and archers fanning out from main ranks. The five deep lines then unfolded and began linking up with those to either side. Cavalry thundered into view on the far left flank, riding hard for a rise to the west. She heard the shouts of confusion from her commanders, felt the recoiling fear of the Shriven.
He opened gates through the walls. He knew we would be studying the barricade, waiting for them to begin dismantling it. He knew we wouldn't advance until they did so. And now we are not ready.
Sister Belai swung round.
Form a line! Form a line! My voice will take their souls, and I will drive the Shriven forward like wolves unleashed. They will ignore their wounds, their fear. They will think only of slaughter. By the time my last soldier falls, the enemy will have ceased to be a military threat. This I swear.
She saw her watered commanders taking control of their companies, their voices powerful as iron-toothed whips. She could feel it now, the cold, implacable sorcery of Akrast Corvalain gathering, and she was pleased at its burgeoning strength. And then someone shrieked, and Sister Belai staggered.
What?
I have lost one of my commanders. How? She saw a swirl of soldiers closing in to where one of the Watered had been standing a moment earlier. Terror and confusion rippled outward. 40 paces distant from that scene, another commander suddenly died, his chest blossoming wounds. They have infiltrated assassins! She awakened her voice. Find them! Assassins! Find them! The companies were in chaos. Facing ranks! Prepare for the enemy! She saw Exigent, heard his shouts as he struggled to reassert order on his milling shriven. As she moved to join him, there was a blossom of darkness behind the man. Sister Belai shrieked a warning, but too late. Knives sank home. Exigent arched in shock and then was falling. Akrust Corvalane, I call upon your power! She set off down the slope. The darkness had vanished, but then, as magic heightened her vision, she could see its swirling path. There would be no hiding from her, not now. A mage! How dare he! No power but mine! And she saw that whirling black cloud stagger, saw it pinned in place, writhing in sudden panic. Hands twitching in anticipation, she advanced on it. Off to her right, she could hear the enemy's horns announce the attack. She would deal with that later. I can still save this. I must. The darkness convulsed in the grip of her power. Now only 6 paces between her and the hidden mage. No power but mine! The sorcery erupted, vanished with a thunderous detonation, and she saw before her a man staggering, sinking down to his knees. Dark-skinned, bald, gaunt. Not the master of the deck. No matter, she would rend him limb from limb. 4 paces, her boots crunching on gravel, and he looked up at her and smiled. Got you. She did not even hear her killer as he came up behind her, but the long knives that burst from her chest lifted her from her feet. She twisted, balanced on 2 hilts, as her slayer raised her yet higher. Then, with a low grunt, he flung her to one side. She was thrown through the air, landing hard, rolling across sharp stones. The bastard had severed the veins beneath both her hearts, and now, lying in her last moments, her head lolled, and she saw him. Burly, ebon-skinned, the long-bladed knives dripping in his hands. Her Watered were all dead. She heard the enemy ranks smashing into her disordered forces. She heard the slaughter begin. Faintly, she caught the mage speaking to the assassin. Sheathe that Ototaril blade, Callum, and be quick about it. And he rumbled a reply. Done. Now, make me invisible again. Their voices grew more distant.
Do you think it's easy? She damned near broke my back with that command.
They were walking away.
Just feeling a tad exposed here, quick. Behind enemy lines and all.
What lines?
Sister Belai closed her eyes.
Ototaril? You unsheathed Ototaril? Oh, you fool.
And these, her last thoughts, bubbled with a kind of dark pleasure. The enemy, broken, routed, war leader Mathok rode up to Paran's position near the westernmost rise and reined in.
High fist! The last have fled east, down into the valley. Shall we pursue?
No, Paran replied, watching as Quick Ben and Kalam approached from across the killing field.
Mathok, begin gathering up forage for your horses. Send parties deeper into the valley if needed. But for resupply only, no chasing down. I fear we shall have to ride hard now.
Where?
South, Mathok, south.
The war leader wheeled his mount round, yelling commands at his second, Tmoral, who waited a short distance back with a wing of cavalry and then rode off in the direction of his main force. Mathok's raiders had been eager, and they had acquitted themselves well. Watching the war leader ride away, Paran rubbed at the back of his neck.
No wonder you winced at every move, Dujek, he said under his breath. I'm a mess of knotted ropes.
Still, the enemy broke at first contact, and what could have been a nasty scrap turned into a slaughter. A mere handful of casualties, and most of those from idiots falling on weapons in their haste to pursue. Ensorcelled voices were all very well, but if that was where all the discipline and courage came from, now we can see the flaw in that, can't we? "Hey, Fist," said Quick Ben, walking up like a man who'd taken a beating. His face was drawn, his eyes skittish with something that might be pain. Paran nodded. "Hi, Mage. Was it as bad as it looks?"
"Not really. Just out of practice. Lost touch with being subtle, I think."
A curious thing to say, Paran reflected, and then he faced Kalam. The assassin's weapons were sheathed, and he looked rather pleased with himself. For no reason he cared to discover, Paran found he wanted to take that smugness down a notch or two. "You've been killing people after all." He regarded him for a moment longer before saying, "Your wife wishes your attention." The man scowled. "Now?" "That was easy. Since you're covered in blood, Corporal, you might want to wash first." Quick Ben snorted.
"I'd forgotten, Callum. You're a lowly corporal, meaning I can order you around." "Just try it, you hood-bitten snake."
After the assassin had left them, the High Mage turned to Paran, hesitated, and then said,
"Felt something far to the southwest."
"As did I, Quick Ben." That skittish look returned.
"Do you know what it was? Do you?"
The High Mage sighed.
"Back to that, then, is it?"
Paran cocked his head. "When I asked Shadow Throne for Kalam, I admit that I didn't expect you to be the delivery man. My last sense of you was in the company of my sister's army, keeping your head down." Quick Ben nodded, looking thoughtful.
"You were able to sniff out things like that? I'm impressed, Genos Paran. You have come a long way from the nervous, gutsick captain I remember from Black Coral."
"I'm still gutsick, High Mage," he said. "And as for sensing distant powers, alas, that's been growing ever more uncertain. And obviously, since coming within the influence of the Asael Warren, I have been effectively blind. But with my sister, it was never easy in the best of circumstances."
"Her sword."
"Her sword, yes. And other things." Quick Ben's nod was sympathetic.
"Sister's eye."
Then his gaze sharpened.
"That manifestation we felt. Do you think, was it her?"
Paran frowned. Just the mention of his stomach had delivered a nip of pain, and then vague nausea, reluctant to fade.
"And look at us, still stepping round each other. Forget all that, Paran. Be honest, see what happens."
"I don't know, High Mage, but I mean to find out." Quick Ben studied the mass of soldiers moving through the enemy supplies, and then he rubbed at his eyes.
"Genos Paran, what are we? Here, what are we?"
Paran felt his face twisting as anxiety gnawed again at his stomach. "Quick Ben, we're soldiers of the Emperor. It's all we ever have been." Quick Ben shot him a look.
"You were just a child when he ruled."
Paran shrugged. "Nonetheless."
"Aye,"
the High Mage muttered like a man trying to swallow bad news.
"Nonetheless. But that empire is gone, Paran, if it ever existed at all."
"Now that's a sharp observation. Nothing lasts, Quick Ben. Speaking of which, how do you warrant Kalam and Minala's chances?" Quick Ben grunted, and the sound might have been wry laughter or sympathy.
"I don't. And while I think they'd be good together, they keep trying to wear each other's skin, if you know what I mean."
"Sort of."
"It's not love that's the problem.
It's all the rest." Quick Ben nodded, and then he shrugged.
"So tell me, O Master of the Deck of Dragons, what awaits us now?"
"That depends."
"On what?"
"Gods below, where do I begin?"
"Start with the worst it could get."
"The worst? How much do you already know?" Quick Ben rubbed vigorously at his face as if trying to rearrange his own features. And maybe become someone else.
Not as much as you might believe, he said. Shadow Throne's not yet gotten over some past slight I offered him. Though for the life of me I can't recall what it might have been. In any case, we're not exactly whispering in each other's ear.
Still, Aran said, not quite convinced.
Well, you have to understand, I usually work alone, and if I need help, I make sure the bargain I make is mutually beneficial. To keep down the chances of taking a knife in the back. I admit it, Hyphist, I really trust no one. No one at all? The trust I have, for some people, comes down to how well I know them, and then it's a matter of my trusting them to do what I think they're going to do.
It's a rather cynical take on trust, Aran observed.
It's the safest. It doesn't take much insight to realize that most people are only looking out for themselves. And once you figure out what they want, you can manipulate them.
The wizard shrugged.
Am I that much of a mystery? I have 12 souls in me. Think about that. All those lives, all those desires, regrets, hurts. Whatever you feel about your life, I have that 12 times over. And some of those souls in me are old.
Yet of necessity you all have to work together for a common purpose.
If you say so.
Aran studied the man. Mystery? What mystery?
Right. Very well. The worst? Here goes then. Kurald Galain falls to vengeful Tist Leosan, and they walk that path right into the heart of Shadow, ousting Shadow Throne, and from there they march onward to this world, joining with the Fokrul Asael in a tide of slaughter, until not one city is left standing, not one field planted, not one human child born into the world. Do you want the rest?
There's more.
The Elder Gods, having at last freed the Outateral Dragon, succeed in the annihilation of magic, barring that paid for in blood, unless, of course, Carabas is killed. But if that happens, it will mean that the Elaint, who are now or will soon be loose in this realm, will have killed it. And they will in turn seek domination, not just of this realm, but of all realms, delivering chaos wherever they go. And so, even with us wiped from the earth, terrible powers will contest the claim to our legacy. The gods will be dead, magic athirst only fools would dare invite, and, well, should I go on?
Quick Ben licked dry lips.
Parts of Bern are dying. On our way here, whenever we touched the soil of this world, I could feel her skin searing, drying and shriveling into something lifeless.
The Outateral Dragon, yes.
I probably already knew that, Quick Ben muttered, just trying not to think about it and hoping it would all go away. Hood's breath! Ganos Paran, tell me what we can do to prevent all this!
The High Fist's brows rose. How unfortunate. That is the question I was going to ask you, Quick Ben.
That's not funny.
Wasn't meant to be.
Your sister?
Aye, my sister. You were with her, wizard? She must have explained her plan.
Quick Ben looked away. She would free the crippled god.
And that's it?
How should I know? Was your whole family like her? Nobody saying a damned thing to each other? Dead silence at the dinner table? Is that how you managed to get along, assuming you got along in the first place?
Paran grimaced. Can't say we did much. Got along, I mean.
What might she be holding inside?
I wish I knew. Quick Ben's growing agitation was evident in his waving hands, his sudden pacing, the sharp, wide-eyed looks he threw at Paran.
I thought you two had this planned.
Had what planned?
You're the master of the deck of dragons.
So I am. Why? You want to play? For a moment, it seemed Quick Ben's eyes would burst from their sockets, and then, with sudden hope...
A reading? Yes, that's it. I'd take a damned reading right now.
Why not?
But Paran was shaking his head. You don't want that, High Mage. Trust me, you don't. There are too many rogue players in this game. Icarium, Draconis, the First Sword of the T'lani Mas, Olar Ethil, Silchas Ruin, Tulas Shorn, Kilava, even Gruntal, the Mortal Sword of Treach. And now the Alaint, and how many dragons have come or are coming through the gate? 100? 1,000? Oh, and the Elder Gods, Erastus, the past Master of the Tiles, and Kilmandaros and her son. Quick Ben was staring as if Paran had lost his mind. Paran scowled. What now?
They're all here?
I have the deck of dragons in my damned skull, remember. I caught the first winds of convergence some time ago. Trust me when I say this will be the biggest the world has ever seen, bigger even than the chaining of the crippled god. Nobody said it'd be easy, High Mage. The question is, what do you have to offer me? Quick Ben snarled.
Why, more good news. What did you think?
What do you mean? The High Mage threw up his hands.
Let's just add the Kachin Chimal and the Jaghut. And, oh, we should probably mention Hood himself, no longer dragging the throne of death by one ankle. And who knows how many slavering fanatics of the Wolves of Winter? And what about the crippled god himself? Will he go quietly? Why should he? If I was him, even if you showed me the inviting door at the far end, I'd be slicing throats all the way down the corridor. I'd have damn well earned the right to as much vengeance as I could muster.
Paran grunted. All right, it's rather more complicated than I had imagined then. Quick Ben seemed to choke on his reply. After a bout of coughing and then spitting, he shook his head and, eyes watering, he rubbed at his face again. Then he took a deep, settling breath and said,
We need a secret weapon, Paran.
I have a gut feeling about that.
The one burning a hole in your stomach?
I hope not. I think we might have two secret weapons, High Mage.
Please, I am begging you, go on.
Quick Ben, tell me, who was the toughest bridge burner you ever knew? Think back and think carefully. Get your ego out of the way. Ignore your favorites and the ones who spent all their time looking mean. Not the callous shits, not the backstabbers, none of the posers. The toughest, Quick Ben. Day in, day out, good times, bad. Tell me, who? The High Mage squinted, glanced down at the ground at his feet, and then he sighed and nodded, looking up as he said,
I didn't need that list, Ganos. I knew my answer right from the start. We all knew.
Who?
Fiddler. There's no tougher man alive.
Paran looked away. My family. Aye, we were something of a mess. But I will tell you this. This one thing I know without any doubt, and it starts with a memory. My sister had an area of ground cleared for her at the country estate, and it was where, beginning when she was barely 5 years old, she used toys to fight battles from every history book and scroll she could find. And the times when my father entertained high fists in his horse-selling ventures, he'd make it a kind of challenge to those veteran commanders. Take to the field against little sallow-faced Tavaray, with all those toy soldiers. Count your attrition honestly and see what happens. My sister, Quick Ben, from about 7 onward, never lost to a single commander. And when their corpses were dragged away, she went deeper into the histories. She started taking the losers' sides, and then won those too.
Tavaray, then.
Think of all the great military leaders, Dasem, Coltane, Kaz, Dujek, Greymane. For what it is worth, I would pit my sister against any of them. Gods below, against all of them. He continued staring into the southwest. There you have it, High Mage. Fiddler and my sister, our two weapons. When he looked back, he saw Quick Ben studying him. The High Mage said, The ascended bridge-burners hold the gates of death.
I know. Except for Hedge. Whiskey Jack sent Hedge back to Fiddler.
Did he now? Remember Pale, Ganos Paran?
As much of it as I could, which wasn't much.
Right. You weren't there yet. Not when we got together on a hill outside the city to shake things down one more time. Or if you were around, sorry was sticking a dagger in your back about then.
What about it, Quick?
It's just, we were all there, trying to make sense of things. And now I've got this feeling we're all going to meet again. To bring it all to an end.
One way or another.
Aye.
How do you gauge our chances, High Mage?
Miserable.
And our weapons?
With me vouching for Fiddler and you for your sister,
he said with a wry grin,
the best we could hope for, I suppose.
And here I have two more. The infamous Callum and Quick Ben. You know, if I wasn't such a realist, I'd be feeling confident right now. A scowl replaced the grin.
Did you really have to put it quite that way, High Fist?
He felt her eyes on him as he swung onto the horse. Settling in the saddle, gathering the reins, he squinted at the broad, terraced valley stretching away to his right. Rich lands, he mused. Then he glanced across at her.
What?
Minala shook her head.
He's going to get you killed for real one of these days. You know that, don't you?
Callum snorted. Whatever you think you've seen, Minala, you'll just have to take my word. You really have no idea what we've survived, me and Quick.
Fine. Impress me.
Probably not possible, but I'll try anyway. Jaghut and Crimson Guard avowed in Mott Wood. Tistandi assassin mages and highborn demons in the Rujistan. More claw than you could count.
Looking across at her, seeing her flat expression, he sighed. And we ain't so bad on our own, neither. Icarium, the Panion Domine, Kachain Naruk, and Soul-Taken Dragons. Quicks faced down them all.
As for me, if I could raise up every person and every demon and every whatever I've personally killed, I'd have an army big enough to drown the Fokrel Asael in piss. Never mind the knockdown fight.
She continued staring at him, and then she said, inflectionless,
you are both insufferable.
Some nerve, he rumbled, after all that attention I just gave you.
On all sides, Paran's host was forming up, preparing to march. They had a third of a day's light left, and it seemed the High Fist wasn't much interested in resting his troops.
In a hurry, that's always bad. Decent-looking soldiers, though. Lots of North Jenabakan and Malazan mainlanders. And then there's those Seven Cities horse warriors, tribals. Tribals always scared me.
Minala took a drink from her water skin and then spoke again.
Were all you bridge burners the same? Arrogant, self-important, narcissistic?
Aye, and we earned every strut.
Rubbish.
In fact, Callum went on, ignoring her comment, it's probably why they decided to wipe us out. Every officer they threw at us couldn't hold up. We were a company run by the sergeants, Whiskey Jack first and foremost, but even then the sergeants voted on stuff, the orders they'd give to the captains and lieutenants, the orders to go down to the rest of us. As you might imagine, the high command didn't much like that. Oh, we might listen to a few, the ones we knew would do right by us, Dasim, Dujek, the ones we knew were worth their salt, but the rest, not a chance.
Meaning you were ungovernable.
Meaning we were actually thinking of taking down the Empress. Aye, looking on it that way, Lassine had to wipe us out. She had no choice. And if it didn't sit well with her, having to kill off her toughest soldiers, well, I suppose we gave her few options.
Well, now,
Minala said,
Finally, a little honesty.
So now I'm with the host, wife. Which brings me to the question, what are you doing here? It ain't safe wherever we're going.
Shadowthren's children, she said. Those that survived, I mean. I couldn't look them in the eye, not after what happened. I couldn't bear it any longer. And I could see Cotillion and Shadowthrone. They were up to something. But mostly, she seemed to shudder, the children and what happened outside the throne room. I'll grant you, Quick Ben didn't hesitate. Even when it looked like he was going to die, he didn't hesitate.
Icarium, Kalam muttered. Maybe one day I'll face off against him and we'll see. Minala snorted.
That'd put a quick end to your arrogance, Kalam Mekar.
A signaller waved a banner, and it was time to ride down to join the vanguard. Kalam thought about Minala's last words and sighed. They kicked their horses into motion, and Kalam asked,
Love, tell me again about that Tist Edur with the spear.
Commander Erikala of the Grey Helms entered the tent to find Brother Serenity standing in a corner at the back, draped in shadows and facing the canvas wall. There was no one else present, and Erikala was brought up short.
Pure?
Serenity slowly turned.
Have you ever been buried alive, Erikala? No, I would imagine not. Perhaps in the occasional nightmare. No matter. Earlier this day, I felt the murder of Sister Belai, and every one of her officers, all dead. The siege has been shattered, and our enemy is now loose within our domain.
Erikala blinked, but said nothing.
Take off your helm, Serenity said. Do you see, over there, a carafe? Foreign wine. I admit to having acquired a taste for it. It serves well in easing my misgivings.
And he went over to pour himself a goblet. He poured a second goblet and gestured to it. Helm now unstrapped and under one arm, Erikala shook his head and said,
Misgivings, Pure? Is not the cause just?
Oh, indeed, Erikala. There will be justice in our tide of retribution. But there will also be crime. We do not spare the children. We do not ask them to remake their world, to fashion a new place of humility, respect, and compassion. We give them no chance to do better.
Pure, said Erikala, as the teachings of the wolves make plain, each and every generation is given a new chance, and each time they but perpetuate the crimes of their fathers and mothers. From the blow that strikes the innocent child to the one that lays waste to a forest, while the magnitude of the gesture may vary, the desire behind the hand does not. So the wild would say, if it but had the words to speak.
Serenity's eyes glittered in the shadows.
And you see no presumption?
Erikala cocked his head.
Pure, the presumptions of the perished Grey Helms are unending. Yet if we refuse, or are unable to comprehend the suffering of the innocent, be it babe or beast, what do our words replace, if not all that we would not hear, would not countenance, lest it force us to change our ways, which we will never do? If we would speak for the wild, we must begin with the voice of human conscience, and when conscience is not heeded, or is discarded, then what choice remains to us?
How clearly you enjoy such debate, Erikala. You remind me of better days, peaceful days. Very well. I will consider what the world would be like for all within it if conscience was more than just a whispering voice.
if indeed it could raise a hand in anger. And when even a sound beating is not enough, it might then close that hand about a throat and take the life from the transgressor.
It is our greatest presumption, Pure, said Erikala, that we be the hand of conscience.
Holding a sword.
And finally driven to use it, yes. Serenity drained his goblet and replaced it with the other one.
Yet your fellow humans, your victims, could not but see you as evil, as terrible murderers of the innocent. In fact, the very notion of guilt or innocence would be without relevance in their eyes.
If we are to be evil, then we but balance the evil that opposes us.
Seeking negation.
And Serenity smiled. Sister Reverence made us kneel, Pure. But we are not so naive as to have come to you expecting anything but the opportunity to give our lives in the name of that which we believe to be right. You will use us until none of us are left. She did not need to compel the parish.
I believe you, Erikala. And I find in you and your people much to admire. I will regret sending you all to your deaths. But, as you might well understand, the wild poses a threat even to us Fokrel Asael, should it truly be unleashed upon the world.
Pure, with my own thrones of war, I have carried your most dangerous enemy to this land. I know well what is coming. It is my judgment, and I am confident that the mortal sword and the shield anvil will concur. It is my judgment, Pure, that in the war now begun, we will all lose, and in our losing, the wild shall win. Serenity was silent for a time, studying the parish commander, the unearthly eyes unwavering. Then, a small catch of breath.
Do I in understanding you, Erikala? You crossed the field of battle to help even the scales?
By all means, Pure, send us to our deaths. Upon the other side, we shall await you. Serenity advanced a step.
I know well these Malazans, and I will welcome them.
The mortal sword Krughava stood before the adjunct Tavaray and placed her sword in the adjunct's hands. Before her, Pure, we did not kneel.
Sister Reverence forced you to kneel, you pompous fool.
Erikala cocked his head. Did she?
You resisted.
Pure, why would we resist? You forget we came to you, not the other way round. Serenity turned, faced the back wall again, his head tilted as he emptied the goblet of wine.
Tomorrow we double our pace, Commander. We will hunt down the foreign army, the murderers of Sister Belai. And your parish will fling themselves into the battle and fight and not yield. If it takes the life of every single one of you, the enemy shall be destroyed.
Precisely, Erikala replied.
Dismissed.
Donning his helm once more, Erikala left the tent. Hips aching, Sister Reverence made her way along the ridge overlooking the now withered farmland. She could see where Brother Diligence had established revetments, arbalest sangers, berms, and trenches. She could see how he intended to funnel the enemy to the place of killing. Only the forward echelons and the engineer corps of the Shriven army were present, the rest remaining closer to the city where supplies could readily accommodate them.
Such an army. 50,000 for this one battle, says Brother Diligence. And soon, more parish greyhelms. 5,000 heavy infantry, fanatical and entirely subject to my desire and brother diligences. And surrounding the spire, 20,000 more, entrenched, immovable. What foe would dare this?
She saw her commander ahead, surrounded by officers and messengers. Old as he was, Brother Diligence seemed to have shed years now that a battle was imminent. As she drew closer, she heard him addressing his officers.
"Shall be starving. We well know how unproductive the Southlands are, and in this weakened state they will gamble everything on a single cast of the die, a solitary, determined, desperate advance. We need but hold them until their energy is spent, for once that strength is gone, they will have nothing in reserve. And then and only then shall we advance. Ah, Sister Reverence, welcome."
"Brother Diligence, all that I see here pleases me."
He tilted his head in acknowledgement.
"Sister, has there been any word from Sisters Calm and Equity?"
"No, but I am not unduly concerned. In truth, we can manage quite well without them."
He frowned, but nodded. They walked a short distance from the officers.
"Brother Diligence,"
she said, studying the preparations,
"I am aware of the spire defences, and of this, your main army. Where are the reserve armies?"
"Sister Freedom and Brother Grave command 20,000 Colant's infantry, positioned 10 leagues to the west. To support them, Brother Aloft oversees 15,000 Shriven auxiliaries. These combined forces are so positioned as either to respond to a breakout from the enemy holding the keep, or to drive south to engage the enemy marching here. Should we perceive the need for them, which I do not."
He fell silent then, and Reverence saw that his attention had been drawn downslope to where a rider was fast approaching.
"News comes," Reverence said. "In haste?"
"From my southern outlying pickets, sister."
The Shriven's horse was lathered, straining with exhaustion as it lumbered up the slope. When the rider reined the beast in, it stumbled and barely recovered. The man, soaked in sweat, dismounted and stood before Diligence.
"Inquisitor,"
he said, struggling to catch his breath.
"A moment," Diligence said. "I see you have ridden hard, Shriven, and such efforts tax your imperfect bodies. Gather yourself, and when you are ready, begin."
The man gulped air for a dozen or so heartbeats and then nodded.
"Inquisitor, a report by relay. 6 days to the south, an army approaches."
"And the size of this army?"
"Perhaps 7,000, Inquisitor."
Diligence gestured one of his officers over.
"Watered Hestand, prepare a single mounted battalion and a full support train. Water and food for at least 3 legions. You are to make haste to intercept the army now marching up from the south. These foreigners are our allies, the land-based element of the Perish Grey Helms. Treat them with respect, Hestand, on your life."
"Yes, sir. Shall I deliver a message from you?"
"A simple welcome will do, until such time as we meet in person. However, it is certain that they will have news of our enemy's disposition, and that I wish to hear immediately. Be sure to have with you a full cadre of messengers and mounts."
The Watered saluted and left. Sister Reverence sighed.
"Soon, then."
She was silent for a moment, and then she faced Diligence.
"It must be understood, brother, that the heart shall be secured above all else. We well know that the gods are gathering, and that they will through force or deceit seek to wrest that organ from us. Failing that, they will attempt to destroy it.
None can hope to come close, sister. The power of Akrast Korvalain denies them and shall continue to do so. Their only possible path to the heart is through their mortal servants.
She feared she was missing something, however. Something vital.
I shall attend the heart, she said. I shall not leave its side.
Understood, Sister Reverence. You will then be accorded a fine view of the battle here, and may well realize our victory before do we on the field.
If instead I see failure, brother, I shall by my own hand destroy the heart.
Prudent, he said.
Is this enough? What else can I do? And why? Why this sudden unease?
She stared southward, eyes narrowing.
Why, brother, do we now face such opposition? Another year, perhaps two, and Akrast Korvalain would be of such power as to dominate this world. And then we could unleash righteous adjudication upon every land in cleansing wrath.
The fallen god has forced their hand, Sister Reverence. We cannot determine precisely how, chained and weakened as he is, but I remain convinced that he is behind this gambit.
Perhaps that is as it should be, she mused. After all, is not his creed the very antithesis of our own? The flawed, the helpless, and the hopeless, daring to stand before holy perfection. The weak of spirit against the indomitable of spirit, the broken against the complete. What astonishes me, Brother Diligence, is their audacity in thinking they could defeat us. Before they even arrive, why, by their very doubts and mutual mistrust, they are already lost.
Diligence's gaunt face pinched into a faint smile.
In a war between fanatics and skeptics, the fanatics win every time.
At her frown, he shrugged.
In the vaults of the palace, sister, our archivists came upon some ancient Jaghut scrolls. Gothos folly. I have been acquainting myself with its peculiar perspective.
She grimaced.
Fanaticism, Brother Diligence, is the harbor of delusions. While to others we may appear no different from fanatics, we are. Fundamentally different, for our cause is a justice beyond our own selves, beyond even our kind. And for all that we Forkrell Asael can but aspire to true perfection, justice stands outside, and its state of perfection cannot be questioned.
When wisdom drips blood, fools stand triumphant.
Reverence shot him a look.
Have those scrolls burned, Brother Diligence. That is a command, not a request.
He bowed. It shall be done at once, Sister Reverence.
And I would hear no more of this Gothos folly. Am I understood?
You are, Sister Reverence. Forgive me.
Her hips throbbed with old pain.
We have walked so far, but at last we make our stand, and we become the fulcrum of the world. And where but upon the fulcrum shall justice be found?
Clouds of dust from the work crews lifted to roll over their position. Discomforted by the sting in her eyes and the bitter taste in her mouth, she turned away.
Carry on, Brother Diligence.
Lying prone in the withered grasses with his gaze fixed on the vast camp sprawled in the plain below, Stormy swore under his breath, reached under his belly and dragged free a sharp stone. Beside him, Gessler scratched at his nose and said,
That looks ominous, doesn't it?
A troop of Perish were marching a half dozen of their comrades, these ones stripped down weaponless and wearing only their undergarments, out to a trench from which diggers were only now climbing. When they were formed into a line facing that trench, they were made to kneel. Sword blades flashed, heads rolled, and bodies fell. Gessler grunted.
"Explains Bent and Roach going mad over those long mounds yesterday."
Sighing, Stormy said,
"If we practiced that, instead of arguing all the time, Guess, we'd have killed each other 1,000 times by now."
"Some people hate it when the party ends."
"Exactly. Listen," said Stormy, "we caught us up with the shits. We should do like Garul says and cut 'em all down, starting with Tanakalian."
"In her worst moments, Krukhava might agree. If we didn't have her under guard, sooner or later she'd be down there trying to do it personally,"
muttered Gessler.
"But it'd still be wrong, not tactical."
"Oh, here we go again. High first fist sword prancing Gessler the Great talking tactics again. Lay a wager the rest of them Perish aren't already waiting in the Asael capital. So instead of taking down 5,000 grey helms here and now, we'll have to take down twice that number a week from now. How does that make tactical sense?"
"Krukhava thinks she can turn them back, Stormy. But now's not the time."
"She also thinks the sun sets up her ass every night and comes out of her mouth every morning. She's unhinged, Guess. You can see that, can't you? Mad as a five-eyed, one-whiskered cat."
"Hold on. Who's that?"
"Who? Where?"
"That girl."
Stormy fell silent, watching. He could see Tanakalian approaching her, was stunned when the shield anvil knelt before her. They were too distant to hear, but by the girl's gestures, pointing at the trench where the bodies and heads had been dumped, she wasn't happy about something, and she was giving that backstabbing shit an earful.
"That must be her," Gessler said. "The one Faint told us about."
"Destriant," Stormy grunted. "But the question is, how in Hood's name did she get here?"
"Warren, she was spat out by the wolves.
If Krukhava's going to have to face anybody down, it'll be her."
"You're probably right, Stormy."
Gessler edged back down the slope of the ridge and then sat up. After a moment, Stormy slid down to join him.
"It's this," Gessler said, wiping dirt from his hands. "The wolves of war, right? So how come that army's acting like they don't even know we're half a day behind them?"
Stormy scratched in his beard.
"Wolves do the hunting. They don't get hunted.
Except by us humans.
Still, might be just never occurred to them to take a look back."
"So maybe the adjunct had it right," Gessler said. "This army of Kachain Chamal is ready to come down like a knife in the middle of the table."
"More like we're like snakes in the grass, and our fangs are fucking dripping."
Stormy smiled without humor.
"Excited yet, mortal sword?"
Gessler's eyes were bright.
"You?
Nah, you're bound to mess it all up."
"That didn't last, thanks."
"Just keep your head level, Guess. That's all I'm asking."
Gessler's expression was incredulous.
"Now that's rich, Stormy, coming from you."
"I'm more battle-hardened these days, Guess. All my wisdom I earned the hard way."
"How are you managing to keep a straight face?"
"That's what us battle-hardened veterans do best. Now let's get back to camp. My mouth is watering at the thought of more armpit fungi and a big tankard brimming with gland juice."
"There is treachery in his heart."
Setok stared down at the beheaded brothers and sisters, feeling the fury of the wolves, struggling to contain its wild wrath. The presence of the beast gods within her surged mindless as a storm, and again she felt as if she was moments from drowning in the deluge.
"I am Setok. Leave me to be your voice. Blind rage is pointless. For all that your cause is just, it must be a human mind that guides us all into the war to come."
And this was what Tanakalian did not understand, or perhaps what he feared the most.
We must be free to speak, all of us. We must be free to object, to argue. Even the wolves do not understand this. Look at these bodies. They spoke out against the cruel pace, among other things. Above all, they spoke out of fear for the readiness of their fellow soldiers. This army is exhausted.
She turned, faced south, her eyes narrowing on a grassy ridge opposite.
If they came for us now, these lizard warriors, we would fall like myriad to the neck hooks. If they came for us now, I would have to awaken the wolves. But the footfall of gods upon the land shall summon like drums of war. Power draws power. Too soon, too far away. Still, I wonder, why do they not attack?
She turned to see Tanakalian approaching.
Another audience. Shall I drive him to his knees again, humiliate him? No, that can wait.
She set off to take the two of them a fair distance from the camp, well beyond earshot.
Still, treachery in his heart.
Even before he caught up to her, he began speaking. Destriant, you must understand. The Perish are bound by strict rules of behavior. It is this discipline which gives us our strength.
You are destroying this army, Shield Anvil.
The Kachain Chemal
have already caught up to us.
His eyes widened, but for once he did not question her. The wolves must be sent against them, Destriant. We cannot hope to...
Now that our soldiers can barely stand, no, you're right, we cannot.
He drew himself up. This threat was ever present in my mind, Destriant. It was my hope that the Kachain Chemal would be content with escorting the Lethary and Balkando. But I knew that I could not gamble the lives of my brothers and sisters on that assumption. This is why I drove my soldiers as hard as I did. We must reach the safety of the Forkeral Asael as soon as possible.
But you have failed to do so, Shield Anvil. And what manner of welcome do you imagine will the Asael accord us when we arrive with an army already half dead?
He was pale, and she could see the venom in his eyes. I had no choice.
You were impatient, Shield Anvil. You exulted in your betrayal, and in so doing you revealed your true nature too soon. Your once allies know the truth of you now, and they have had time to adjust their tactics.
This is Krughava's fault, all of it!
There shall be no more executions, Shield Anvil. Worse, your denial of their embrace has made a mockery of your title. I look upon you, and I can see, at last, the path that led to the Forkeral Asael.
Shock twisted his face. What does that mean? I am sworn to the Wolves of Winter!
You are drunk on justice, Shield Anvil. And for all that you imagine, you walk a straight line. In truth, you stumble and weave. Now you stand before me, deluded in your righteousness, and upon the path where you walked.
She gestured back towards the bodies in the trench.
The corpses of the innocent.
The delusions, he said in a low rasp, are not mine, child. Setok smiled.
Go on. I am intrigued.
Do you truly believe you can withstand the will of the Forkeral Asael? We shall be brought to heel, but that is not how it was supposed to be. Their aims are petty compared to ours. For all their claims, Destriant, the truth is, I intended to use them. They demand that we kneel? So be it. It matters not. The wolves are blind to all of this. We think in ways they cannot comprehend, and this game will not be won with slavering jaws and berserk rage. Against us, that has never worked. No, the Wolves of Winter are better off hiding in the forest, in the dark shadows. Leave us to do what must be done, and when all the players are weakened, then shall come the time for our gods to attack. After all, is that not the way of the wolves in the wild?
Tanakalian, said Setok. I agree with you. But alas, I cannot choose the times when the gods speak through me. I will have no control over their power the day it steals my will. Their anger will overwhelm, and through their eyes they will see nothing but blood.
That is not how to fight a war.
I know.
He stepped forward, a sudden hope in his eyes. Then you must work with me, Destriant. We can win this. Win it in truth. Warn the wolves. If they manifest within reach of the Forkerel Asael, they will be murdered, or worse, enslaved.
Then stand before me now as a true shield anvil. It is not for you to judge, not for you to deny your brothers and sisters, and above all, it is not for you to take their lives.
Tanakalian pointed back to the bodies in the trench. They would have deserted, Destriant. They would have fled back to Krughava, carrying with them vital information. Their crime was treason.
They sought to raise a new mortal sword, she said. For the field of battle, they sought a veteran to command them. You killed them because of a personal slight, Tanakalian.
Matters were far more complicated than you realize. She shook her head.
You face a crisis, Shield Anvil. Your soldiers have lost confidence in you. It is crucial that you understand. If not for me, this army would return to Krughava.
Unleash the wolves upon the Kachain Chimau. Buy us the time we need.
It will not be.
Why not?
Because they refuse, Shield Anvil.
But why? Setok shrugged.
The Kachain Chimau were never the enemy of the beasts. They were never so insecure as to feel the need to slaughter everything in sight. They were never so frightened, so ignorant, so pathetic. I believe the wolves do not see them as deserving of slaughter.
And will they change their minds when those lizards attack us? She fixed on him a sharp, searching stare.
What will the wolves witness? Kachain Chimau cutting down humans.
But we perish are to be their swords of vengeance.
Then we can only hope that we do not face the Kachain Chimau on a field of battle.
Do you finally comprehend the necessity, the burden upon us, Destriant? We must stand in the shadow of the Forkerel Asael. We must be free to choose where and when to fight, and indeed whom we shall face. Let the Asael believe they have us well shackled and compliant, eager even.
You balance everything on the thinnest knife edge, Shield Anvil.
We are the Grey Helms, Destriant, and we shall serve the wolves.
Indeed.
And that is why we must continue marching at this pace. Leave the lizards no time to think about what to do about us. And if they chase our tails right into the Asael army, well, the moment those two ancient foes set sight upon each other...
We need only step aside.
He nodded. Dismissing him for the moment, Setok turned away.
Perhaps. Is this the treachery I sense in Tanakalian? And if I cannot agree with his methods, must I then reject his intentions? But the game he would play, poised between two such deadly enemies, is it possible? No. Ask yourself this instead, Setok. What alternative do we have?
When she turned, he was standing as he had been, facing her, and in his face, blind need.
Are you clever enough for this, Shield Anvil?
I see no other way, Destriant. He hesitated, and then he said, Each night I pray to the wolves of winter. She turned away again, and this time with finality.
You waste your breath, Shield Anvil.
What?
They don't understand, worshippers, she said, closing her eyes. They never did.
Once more, staggering lost, the darkness and the unbearable pressure, the raging currents that sought to rend the flesh from his bones, and on all sides the half-buried wreckage of the lost. He stumbled over rotted planks from broken hulls, kicked up bleached bones that flashed and spun in milky clouds. Silt-painted amphorae, ingots of tin and lead, a scattering of hundreds of round shields, hammered bronze over crumbling wood. Banded chests collapsed and spilling out their gems and coins, and everywhere the remains of sea creatures, their insensate bodies dragged down into the depths, and the rain from above was unending. Bryce Bedict knew this world. Was this yet another dream, a haunting from his memories? Or had his soul at last returned to this place he would learn to call home? Above all, the greatest pressure he felt, the one force which neither the strength of his legs nor the stolid stubbornness of his will could withstand, was that of immense, devastating loneliness. Into death we step alone. Our last journey is made in solitude. Our eyes straining, our hands groping. Where are we? We do not know. We cannot see. It was all he needed. It was all anyone needed. A hand to take ours. A hand reaching out from the gloom. To welcome us, to assure us that our loneliness, that which we knew all our lives and so fought against with each breath we took, that loneliness has at last come to an end, making death the most precious gift of all. 1,000 sages and philosophers had closed desperate fingers about the throat of this one thing, even as they recoiled in horror, or, with a defiant cry, leapt forward. Tell us, please. Show us your proofs. Tell us oblivion has a face, and upon it the curve of a smile, the blessing of recognition. Is that too much to ask? But this, he knew, was the secret terror behind all faiths. The choice to believe, when to not believe, invited the horror of the meaningless. All these lives empty of purpose, all these hopes relinquished, dropped from the hand, left to sink in the thick mud, with silts raining down until everything is buried. I knew a man who studied fossils. He had made this pursuit his entire life. He spoke with great animation about his need to solve the mysteries of the distant past. And this guided his life for decades, until in a confession written the night he took his own life, he finally spoke of the truth he had at last discovered. I have found the secret, the one secret that is the past. The secret is this. There are more life forms in the history of this world than we could ever imagine, much less comprehend. They lived and they died, and what little remains tells us only that they once existed. And therein hides the secret, the terrible secret. It's all for nothing. Nothing but fragments of bone. All of it for nothing. Easy enough to understand how this could have unleashed the black dogs, when comprehension yielded only a vast abyss. But then Bryce found a familiar face rising before him, there in his beleaguered memories, or dream world, whichever this was. Tehol, and that look in his eyes that one might see the moment before he spat in the face of every god that ever existed, only to then move on to the dour mendics and philosophers and wild-haired poets. Damn them all, Bryce. No one really needs an excuse to give up on life, and all the ones you hear, you might as well pluck out of a hat. Surrender is easy, fighting is hard. Brother, I remember once reading about deadly swords that, in the moment of war, would howl with laughter. What better symbol of human defiance than that? Sure, Bryce, I remember that bone collector. He got it all wrong. With that secret he discovered, he had a choice. Despair or wonder. Between the two, which would you choose? Me? I look at the idiocy and futility of existence, and how can I not wonder? Every creature dies, brother. You should know. I'd wager that each and every one of those creatures set out into the darkness, soul crouched and timid, not knowing what waited ahead. Why should us smart animals be unique? Death levels us with cockroaches and the rats and the earthworms. Faith is more than turning our backs on the abyss and pretending it's not there, Bryce. It's how we climb up above the cockroaches. Top of the ladder, lads! And those 7 rungs make all the difference. 8? 8 rungs, then. Up here, the gods can finally see us, right? Remember that other sage who said the soul is carried from the body by maggots? Crush a maggot, kill a soul. And damn, but they'd have to crawl far,
so the gods gave them wings to carry them up into the heavens. Makes for a strangely logical theory, don't you think? Where was I, brother? More to the point, where are you?
The face of Tehol drifted away, leaving Bryce alone once more.
Where am I, Tehol? I am nowhere.
He stumbled, he groped blindly, he staggered beneath unimaginable weights, too ephemeral to shrug off, yet heavy as mountains nonetheless, and on all sides unrelieved darkness.
But no, is that light? Is that?
In the distance, a lantern's yellow flame, murky, flaring and ebbing in the currents.
Who? Do you see me?
A hand reaching out, the curve of a smile on a welcoming face.
Who are you? Why do you come for me, if not to bless me with revelation?
The stranger held the lantern low, as if no longer caring what it might reveal, and Bryce saw that he was a Tist Edur, a grey-skinned warrior wearing tattered leathers that streamed behind him like tentacles. Step by step, he drew closer. Bryce stood in the man's path, waiting. When the Edur arrived, he looked up, dark eyes staring with an inner fire. His mouth worked, as if he'd forgotten how to speak. Bryce held up a hand in greeting. The Edur grasped it, and Bryce grunted as the man leaned forward, giving him all his weight. The face, pitted and rotted, lifted to his own. And the Edur spoke.
Friend, do you know me? Will you bless me?
When his eyes snapped open, Erenicht was ready for him, ready for the raw horror of his expression, the soul exposed and shaken to its very core. And she took him tight in her arms, and knew, in the pit of her heart, that she was losing him.
Back. He's on his way back, and I cannot hold on to him. I cannot.
She felt him shudder, and his flesh felt cold, almost damp.
He smells of salt.
It was some time before his breathing calmed, and then once more he was asleep. She slowly disengaged herself, rose, throwing on a cloak, and stepped out from the tent. It was near dawn, the encampment still and quiet as a graveyard. Overhead, the jade strangers cut a vast swath across the night sky, poised like talons about to descend. She drew out her tinderbox and a stick of rust leaf to ease the gnawing hunger. This land was ruined, in many ways far worse than the wastelands. All around them were signs of past prosperity, entire villages now empty, abandoned to weeds, dust, and the scattered remnants left by those who had once lived there. The fields surrounding the farms were blown down to rocks and clay, and not a single tree remained, only stumps or, here and there, pits where even the stumps had been dug out. There was no animal life, no birds, and every well they examined, every stream bed her minor mages worked over, seeking to draw water from the depths, yielded little more than soupy sludge. Their few remaining horses were suffering and might not even make it into Calanth proper.
And the rest of us aren't doing much better. Low on food, exhausting ourselves, sinking wells, and knowing that somewhere ahead a well-rested, well-fed army waits for us.
She drew hard on the stick, looked eastward to the distant camp of the Balkando. No fires, even the standards tilted like the masts of some foundered ship.
I fear we won't be enough, not to do what the adjunct needed, what she wanted. It may prove that this entire journey will end in failure and death.
Bryce came out of the tent to stand beside her. He took the stick from her fingers and drew on it. He'd begun doing that a few weeks past, seeking, perhaps, to calm his nerves in the wake of his nightmares. But she didn't mind. She liked the company.
I can almost taste the thoughts of my soldiers, he said. We will have to kill and eat the last horses. Won't be enough, even sparing the water to make a stew. Ah, if we could have scavenged, this might have succeeded.
We're not done yet, my love. Please, I beg you, do not answer that with yet another sad smile.
With each one, I feel you slip further away.
It is our growing weakness that worries them the most, he said. They fear we won't be fit to fight.
The parish, if anything, will be even worse off.
But they will have some days in which to recover. Besides which, Aranicht, one must fear more than the Asael army.
She lit a second stick and then gestured with one hand. If all of Calanth is like this, they won't have an army.
Queen Abrastel assures me that Calanth continues to thrive. With what the sea offers and the fertile valley province of Estebanz continues to produce, sheltered from the drought.
And each night the nightmares take you, and each night I lie awake watching you, wondering about all the other paths we could have taken. How have we failed her? Aranicht asked. What more could we have done?
Bryce grimaced. This is the risk when you march an army into the unknown. In truth, no commander in his or her right mind would even contemplate such a precipitous act. Even in the invasion of new territories, all is preceded by extensive scouting, contact with local elements, and as much background intelligence as one can muster. History, trade routes, past wars.
Then without the Balkando, we would truly be marching blind. If Abrastel had not concluded that it was in her kingdom's interest to pursue this, Bryce, have we misjudged the adjunct from the very beginning? Did we fall into the trap of assuming she knew more than she did? That all that she had set out to do was actually achievable?
That depends.
On what?
He reached over and took the new stick of rust leaf. On whether she has succeeded in crossing the glass desert, I suppose.
A crossing that cannot be made.
He nodded. Yes.
Bryce, not even the adjunct can will her Malazans to achieve the impossible. The world sets physical limits, and we must live by them, or those limits will kill us. Look around. We are almost out of food and water, and this land has nothing to give us. And just as the farmers and villagers all fled or perished, so too are we faced with the same hard reality. The country is destroyed.
He seemed to be studying the sky. My father was not an imaginative man. He could never understand me and Tehol, especially Tehol. Our brother Hull, well now, he started out as the perfect eldest son, only to be pronounced dead in the eyes of father.
He was silent for a few moments, smoking, and then he resumed.
Beyond all the tutors foisted upon us, it was our father who insisted on delivering his one lesson. Even if it killed us, he would teach us the value of pragmatism. Which is, as I am sure you well understand, nothing more than a cogent recognition of reality, its limits, its demands, and its necessities.
Aranicht cocked her head, wondering at the direction of his thoughts. Beloved, of all men, the name of Tehol does not come to mind when I think pragmatic.
He glanced across at her. And what of me?
In you, yes. You are a weapon master, after all. I never knew Hull, so of him I cannot say.
So you conclude that of the three Bedict brothers, I alone absorbed our father's harsh lessons in pragmatism.
She nodded.
Bryce looked away again, this time to the southeast. How far away, do you think, lies the coast?
Proper marching, 3 days, if the Queen's maps are at all accurate.
Oh, he murmured, I'm sure they are.
It's almost dawn, Aranicht said.
We will not march today, my love.
She shot him a look. A day's rest at this point could prove counterproductive. He flicked away the stick, eyes tracking the glowing end.
Before he changed his mind about things, Tehol became the wealthiest man in Lether, Aranicht. Ask yourself, how could he have done that? If in pragmatism he was an utter failure.
He faced the camp.
Today we eat the last of our food and drink the last of our water.
Bryce?
I think, he said, I will walk over to the Balkando camp. Will you join me, love?
Mud of the gods, woman, what are you doing?
Abrastel looked up.
What does it look as if I'm doing, Spax?
Her fiery tresses lay heaped on the tent floor. She was wrapped in her blanket, and as far as he could tell, naked underneath. He watched as she resumed slashing long lengths away with her knife.
I witness, he said, the death of my lust.
Good, it's about time. I was never going to bed you, Bargast.
Not the point. It was the desire I took so much pleasure in.
That's pathetic. Spax shrugged.
I am an ugly man. This is how ugly men get through each damned day.
You've been bedding my daughter.
She only does it to infuriate you, Highness.
Abrastel paused with her knife, looked up at him. And has it succeeded? Grinning, Spax said,
So I tell her every night. All about your rants, your foaming mouth, your outrage and fury.
Ugly and clever, a deadly combination in any man.
Or woman, I would wager.
What do you want?
My scouts have returned from the coast, Highness, with news.
Finally, she sensed something in him, in his tone, or the look in his eyes, for she slowly straightened.
Are we flanked, War Chief? No enemy in sight, Highness.
Then what? As you can see, I'm armed, and my patience is getting as short as my hair.
Ships were sighted. A ragtag fleet.
Ships? Under what flag?
Lethary, Highness.
Suddenly, she was on her feet. Her hair only half shorn, she flung the knife away. The blanket slipped down, and Spax found himself staring at her magnificent body.
Highness, I could live with that short hair.
Get out of here and send a messenger to Bryce.
No need, Highness. About the messenger, I mean. He and Aranicht are even now approaching camp.
She was casting about for her clothes. Now she paused.
This was planned, Spax shrugged. Possibly. But then, why not tell us? I'm more inclined to think this gesture was made by the king entirely on his own.
She grunted. You might be right. What else did the scouts see?
Landings, Highness. Battalion strength, lethary infantry and auxiliaries. And more supplies than any single battalion would ever need.
Was the Imperial Standard flying? Does King Tehol command?
No, only the battalion colors were present, as far as my scouts could determine. In any case, just this last night, my scouts realized that riders were on their trail. They too will be upon us shortly.
She was still standing before him in all her glory.
What are you still doing here? Answering your questions, Highness.
I am finished with my questions. Get out!
One more detail you might be interested in learning, Spax said. Among the auxiliaries, Highness, there are Teblor.
Abrastel and Warchief Spax were waiting outside the Queen's tent, and Aranicht studied them as she and Bryce approached. Both were arrayed in their full regalia, the Queen looking imperial, though the hair on one side of her head was shorn away, and the Gilk Warchief festooned in weapons and wearing an ankle-length cloak made of turtle shells.
What is this? What has happened?
Abrastel was the first to speak.
Prince Bryce, it seems we shall be entertaining guests shortly.
Before you ask, Bryce replied, this was not arranged beforehand. However, the last messengers I sent back to my brother detailed what we then knew of our route. At the time, we were 10 days into the wastelands.
Still, she said, the timing of this is extraordinary.
My brother's seeder is able to sense, even at a great distance, sorcerous efforts seeking groundwater. He turned slightly to nod at Aranicht. As you know, our legion mages have been engaged in such rituals ever since we left the wastelands.
Abrastel's voice was flat.
Your seeder was able to track us based on the drawing of water from the ground. While he sits ensconced in the palace in Letharus? You expect me to give credit to that explanation, Prince? Not even a god could reach that far.
Yes, well.
They could hear horses now, coming in from the southeast, and the Balkando camp was suddenly stirring, as exhausted, suffering soldiers left their bivouacs to line the main avenue between tent rows. Voices were lifting, and now Aranicht could see the vanguard. She squinted at the pennants.
"Sire," she said to Bryce, "Lethary, yes, but I do not recognize the heraldry. What battalion is that?"
"A new one, I would hazard," Bryce replied.
The battalion commander halted his troop with a gesture and then rode forward until he was 10 paces from Bryce and the others. He dismounted in a clatter of armor, removed his helm, and then walked to kneel before the prince.
"It is Tenedict, sire, commanding the Chancel Battalion."
"Please stand, commander," said Bryce. "Your arrival is most welcome. It is Tenedict. I believe I know that family name, though at the moment I cannot place it."
"Yes, sire. My father was one of your brother's principal stakeholders and numbered among the first to go under on the day of losses."
"I see. It seems, however, that the Tenedict family has recovered from its misfortune."
"Yes, and the king has seen fit to reward us, sire."
"Excellent.
In the form of community service, under his new program of indebtedness to the community, sire. As the middle son and facing few prospects, I elected to take the military route for my community service, while the rest of the Tenedict family set to reforming the impoverished conditions of the indigents out on the isles."
Abrustal made a sound somewhere between disbelief and disgust.
"Forgive my interruption, commander. Am I to understand that the King of Lesser, having ruined your family's wealth, has since seen fit to demand from you a period of public service?"
"That is correct, Highness."
"How is that even remotely fair?"
Idist managed a faint smile as he regarded her.
"On the matter of fairness, Queen, King Tehol had much to say to my father and all those others who profit from the debts of others."
Abrastel scowled. "Speaking from a position of great privilege, I find that offensive."
"Highness," said Idist, "I believe that was the point."
Bryce spoke. "Commander, you bring not only yourselves, but also resupply, is that correct?"
"It is, sire. In addition, I carry a written missive from the king, addressed to you."
"Do you have it with you?"
"I do, sire."
"Then please read it to us."
The young commander's brows lifted.
"Sire, perhaps some privacy?"
"Not at all, commander. You seem to have the voice of a drill sergeant as it is. Lend it to my brother's words, if you please."
All at once the man was sweating, and Aranicht felt a sudden sympathy. She leaned close to Bryce.
"You might want to reconsider, love. This is your brother, after all."
"Yes, and?"
"His own words, Bryce."
The prince frowned.
"Ah, right."
But Idist had begun.
"Greetings to Prince Bryce from King Tehol, the only of Lether. Dearest brother, have you slept with her yet?"
Wisely he paused then and looked up at the prince. On all sides, from the soldiers within earshot to Abrastel and Spax, there was deathly silence. Sighing, Aranicht lit a stick of rust leaf. Bryce stood, one hand over his eyes, and then, with a helpless gesture, bade Idist continue.
"Never mind, we can talk about that later. But let it be known that as king I can command from you every detail down to the very last, detail. All the while promising that my wife will never hear a single word of any of it. Since, as I am sure you have now discovered, pillow talk can be deadly. Best I turn now to the dull official content next, so that we can later return to the juicy details. I feel justified in such expectations since I have discovered that women actually engage in the most horrendously explicit discussions of their menfolk when in the company of their bosomed friends, inviting tit for tat, and what tit could be more inviting than tat?"
Spax burst out a harsh laugh and then ducked.
"Sorry, that was just me being appalled."
Idist resumed.
"Official now. Bug formed up his own battalion, found an able commander for it, and then hired a fleet to transport said reinforcements along with all the resupply he could wedge into the holds. And then, following my proclamation of the sovereignty of the indigents out on the isles, Bug oversaw all the Teblor, who, strangely, rushed to join the Lethary military with the aim of accompanying the Chancel fleet.
Between you and me, the Teblor have to be the most contrary people I have ever known. Anyway, with all of Bug doing this and Bug doing that, I'm understandably exhausted and I graciously accept your sympathy. To continue, the battalion now has 300 Teblor in its auxiliaries. I believe some ancient prophecy has them in an advanced state of excitement. Just as my very own prophecy of your impending love life having now come true, I trust, why, I am left in an advanced state of excitement. But not improperly so, I assure you. That would be sick. Never mind tales of war and mayhem, brother. Spin me a romance. Trapped in a palace and chained to a wife, well, you can imagine my desperation here. Sincerely, as I am to put into practice a new period of austerity here in the palace, I have just discovered the error of dictating this missive to my wife. So, I will take this moment, before fleeing the room, to send to you all my love and to extend my warmest greetings to everyone else whom you have forced into the awkward position of hearing this. With deepest affection, your loving brother, King Tehol.
Prince Bryce, murmured Abrustel, you have my sympathies.
Bryce sighed, and then, in a remarkably calm and steady voice, he addressed Idist.
Commander, when will the battalion arrive?
They have already begun their march, sire. 2 days behind us. I left orders to push on into the night and rise before dawn, so with luck they will arrive by dusk tomorrow.
Thank you, Commander.
As they walked back to the Lethary encampment, Idist and his troop maintaining a respectful distance behind them, Aranect took Bryce's hand.
All that cheering and laughter, that was ingratitude. You do realize that, don't you?
He frowned.
Bryce?
He does it on purpose, you know. Sees me as far too serious. But then it just so happens I'm about to lead my soldiers into war. We have marched a long way and have suffered deprivations, and our enemy awaits us, fit, rested, and probably thoroughly entrenched. That enemy will be choosing the ground, and to make matters worse, they will probably outnumber us by a wide margin.
Nothing he said made light of that, she responded, and by his gesture alone you must know that he worries for you. This resupply gives us a fighting chance.
I know. And of course I'm grateful. How could I not be?
Idist did warn you.
Bryce shook his head.
It's not the letter, Aranect.
It isn't?
What just happened back there played out in Tehol's mind even as he dictated the lines to his wife. He knew I would want his words read out loud. My brother is diabolical and thoroughly shameless. I have spent my whole life walking wide-eyed into his snares, and none of it bothers me. In fact, I cannot help but admire his genius every time.
Aranect was baffled.
Bryce, what is it then?
I cannot recall, Aranect, and I've been trying. I cannot recall Tehol ever saying that he loved me. And that alone is the measure of his concern, and it's shaken me to the core.
Bryce,
Tehol fears we will not see each other again. For all its mundane silliness, he came as close to saying goodbye as anyone could without using the word itself. And so, as you perhaps can now imagine, I miss him. I miss him dearly.
She held tight onto his hand, as if that could help, when she knew that it could not. But she had nothing to say to him. Her mind was blank, echoing in the wake of what had just rushed through it.
He expects to die. My love expects to die.
The relief wagons rolled into the camp, and for the first time Shield Anvil Tanakalian set eyes upon a Forkral Asael. Or so he thought, only to subsequently discover that the man was but a half-blood, a watered. No matter, there was something of a nightmare about him, the skin white as papyrus, the way he moved, his arms crooking like snakes, the sinuous flow of his strides, and the ghastly coldness in his pallid eyes. These are the deadliest of allies. I am not blind to the contempt you have for us, when you look upon our beleaguered, battered condition.
But we shall recover, and swiftly, and when the time comes to do what is necessary, we shall be ready." He saw Setoc standing apart, ignoring the Watered and his officers, ignoring everyone and everything. Was she caught in the grip of the wolves? Did they stare out now from her mismatched eyes? She is a liability, but it's not her fault. The wolves have taken her. They use her. She is nothing more than a portal, and when the gods choose to manifest in this world, they will tear right through her. I doubt she will even survive. If necessary, I will seal that portal. I will stop the wolves from coming. I will do this to save their lives. So his prayers went unanswered. By her words, she had made plain that the priests of the Grey Helms were all fools, self-deluded in believing they could touch the mind of the wild. And generations of Perish who gave their lives to the wolves. A waste. All that blood spilled. And the struggles for power, those precious titles of Mortal Sword, Shield, Anvil, Destriant, they all meant nothing. And therein lurks the cruelest truth of all. In the end, we are no different from every other cult, every other religion. Convincing ourselves of the righteousness of our path. Convincing ourselves that we alone hold to an immutable truth, secure in the belief that everyone else is damned. But it was all a game, the sacred, a playground for secular power struggles, venal ambition. What's left to believe in? His thoughts swirled, spun in a vortex, taking him down and down to Krughava. Did you see through it all? Did you decide that personal glory was all there was, the only thing worthy of aspiration? Are you, Krughava, the reduction of the argument? Make your last stand. Die neck deep in integrity and honor and duty. Those words are borne on a flag in three shades of red. And you will rally to that standard, and once there, you will happily die. Very well, Krughava. I can make sense of you now. It does not help, because still I will not follow you. But at least I understand. They didn't need Setoc. The Grey Helms would be the wrath of the wolves, the fury of the wild, but without risk to the wolves. Yes, this is war, but do not come here. Not to this one. If you do, they will take you. If you do, gods will die on that day. I will not have it. He realized that he stood between the two, between Krughava and Setoc, between the profane and the sacred, and yet to neither would he give his embrace. Poised on the knife edge indeed. I am the shield anvil, and the virtue of blessing is my one and my only virtue. Yet here I stand, trapped, unwilling to reach out to either one. It seems that the glorious death shall be mine, after all.
Shield Anvil?
He turned, found himself facing the Watered commander. Yes?
I suggest you rest and feed for this night. Come the dawn, we can begin our march to Blessed Gift.
Excuse me, where?
Blessed Gift is the old name for the plain where awaits the Kolant's army. It was a land once rich with wheat.
Tanakalian smiled, looked away. Very well.
Shield Anvil?
He glanced back. What is it? The Watered tilted his head.
I was about to comment on the impressive courtesy in the manners of your soldiers.
Forgive me, said Tanakalian. Voice tight. I am distracted.
Of course. Brother Diligence wishes to know, are those pursuing you the only threat we should expect?
Those pursuing? But I say nothing of the Kachain Chemal. Not to you, not to any of you.
I believe so. However, Shield Anvil?
There was an army of foreigners, but they attempted to cross the Glass Desert. It is probably safe to assume that they have failed.
I agree. We have sensed nothing impinging upon us from that direction.
Tanakalian nodded.
Well, I doubt you would have anyway, but it pleases me to hear your certainty in your assessment that the glass desert cannot be crossed. A moment, Shield Anvil. You say to me that you do not think we would sense their appearance. Why is that? Tanakalian's eyes wandered past, settled once more on Setok. He shrugged. Their commander wields an Ototaral sword. Not that it could save. He stopped then, for the Warthog was marching back to his entourage, shouting commands in the Kalansi language. In moments, three riders wheeled their mounts and set out at a gallop northward. When he glanced back at Setok, he found her staring at him. The Shield Anvil realized that he was sweating, his heart beating fast in his chest. "It's just an Ototaral sword," he muttered, baffled at the Warthog's obvious alarm, unnerved by Setok's sudden attention. "Calm yourself. Hold to the knife's edge. Breathe deeply. Breathe."